In Ukraine, the war is taking a toll on doctors. Physicians are facing cases far outside their specialties.
We have the training as part of general surgery training, but you cannot even compare what types of injuries and complications we had to face.
Also today, in El Salvador, excitement over Elon Musk's new satellite internet company and promises of greater online access. YouTubers sing the praises, but will Salvadorans be able to afford it? Plus, volcanoes are rumbling near population centers in Mexico, Italy, and Central Africa. Volcanologists say three at once, no big deal.
We just only hear about the ones that are near major population centers. So this is business as usual for planet Earth.
I'm Marco Werman. All that and more coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for spending part of your Friday with us. Today in Ukraine, the flaming aftermath of a medical clinic. Rescue teams there putting out the fires from Russian airstrikes. This was in the eastern Ukrainian city of Dnipro. Two people were killed, two dozen more were injured. The clinic was completely destroyed. The World Health Organization says there have been more than 700 attacks on healthcare facilities since Russia's full-scale invasion began more than a year ago. The World's Bianca Hillier starts us off today looking at the challenges Ukrainian physicians have been facing and new efforts to get help from abroad.
At 5 a.m. on February 24th, 2022, Dr. Ali Jamiliev woke up to the sound of explosions.
I checked the telephone and realized that the full-scale war is started, and it's much worse than anyone can expect.
Jamiliev lived close to Bucha at the time. It's a city just north of Kyiv. Dr. Inessa Hoivanyuk was in Kyiv that day and remembers her morning commute to work.
It was shocking because as I was on the train, other people with kids, their pets, like whatever they could grab from their homes, they were leaving the city.
When she got to the hospital, where she works as a surgical oncologist, she spent the day discharging as many people as possible.
Because we didn't know how safe this hospital is to keep those people. And if you can physically move and your relatives can come and take you, this is the best that you can do. But there were patients who were just after surgery, who couldn't move, who were intubated even. So that was a huge challenge.
The hospital soon told Hoivanyuk to leave too. So she and 12 friends piled into a couple cars and drove west to her hometown, where her parents were waiting. Jamiliev, a general surgeon, also headed in that direction to relative safety.
I moved completely to this small rural hospital in Kapichinsky and was helping local surgeons.
He says the entire hospital only had two surgeons when he arrived. They quickly became inundated with injured people who had fled eastern and central Ukraine.
And I spent 2.5 months in this place eating the same food patients ate. I was living and sleeping in the ward.
Outside the hospital, air alerts would go off 4 or 5 times a day.
It was pretty difficult and challenging to continue working and operating and taking care of patients in this environment.
Hoivanyuk returned to her hospital in Kyiv in early April.
And it was a completely different city. Like, it was like apocalypse city.
The hospital she works at had changed, too. Instead of only treating cancer patients, Hoivanyuk and her colleagues were now treating injured soldiers and civilians. But they weren't that well equipped.
We have the training as part of general surgery training, but you cannot even compare what types of injuries and complications we had to face. Every day was like a learning day for everyone, even for super, super experienced surgeons.
So when Hoivanyuk found out that Harvard was inviting Ukrainian physicians to train at its affiliated hospitals, she jumped at the opportunity. She arrived in Boston in March of this year for a fellowship run by Scholars at Risk and Heal Ukraine Group. Dr. Mark Poznanski helped form the latter in 2022. He's an infectious disease specialist.
Helping Ukraine was urgent, not something that could be done in a couple of years.
Poznanski says they've so far welcomed a half dozen physicians from Ukraine. The doctors are getting crucial training to care for trauma patients, but they're also focusing on the future of the country's healthcare system.
So in other words, it's sort of transformational. It's not just meeting the acute need. It's actually meeting a longer-term need to repair, rebuild, restore a modern healthcare system in Ukraine.
A modern healthcare system includes mental health. Psychiatrist Dr. Sophia Hrechu is one of the fellows who spent time in Boston.
Psychiatrists are very needed right now, and we're going to be even more needed when it's all over because of the PTSD stuff and all the other mental issues.
While at Harvard, Hrechu studied how to treat soldiers, which she'd never done before this war. That's helping her every day now, back in Lviv. But she also learned how to integrate psychiatric units into general hospitals. It's common practice in the States, but is rare in Ukraine.
And I'm going to be running the next one when we build it. So I'm feeling excited, but a little bit stressed, let's be honest.
Ali Jamilov has come to Boston, too. He's focusing on Ukrainian patients whose conditions have nothing to do with the war.
Because there are many cancer patients and other aspects of healthcare and medicine which shouldn't be neglected during wartime.
Jamilov is also continuing a project he launched in the early days of the war, when a patient with a tooth infection came to his surgical department for help because there were no more dentists in town. Jamilov realized Ukrainian hospitals needed more resources and created an app to help.
This is called HealUA, right? Mm-hmm.
He walked me through how doctors can use the app to ask other physicians for advice when they have cases outside of their specialties.
You open and you see submitted cases. The person who submitted this, he's explaining what happened to patient here. He attached some pictures, mm-hmm. right? And he's asking, what is the suspected diagnosis, you
okay.
see?
Doctors from Ukraine, Europe, and the U.S. can sign up for free, and everyone is verified before they're able to chime in. 2,200 physicians have joined, and 170 cases have been submitted. While hospitals remain under attack across the country, Jamilov says these efforts show Ukrainian doctors they're not alone. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
A volcano near Mexico City has been rumbling for about a week, spewing an ominous column of ash and scaring locals. Authorities are preparing for a possible evacuation of millions of people. Mexico isn't the only spot seeing volcanic activity. It's also been observed in the Democratic Republic of Congo and at Europe's most active volcano, Mount Etna, on the Italian island of Sicily. To get a roundup of all the world's volcano action, we reached out to writer, science educator, and volcanologist Jess Phoenix. Let's start with Mexico City, Jess. The peak there, Popocatépetl, El Popo for locals, it's technically a stratovolcano. Explain what that is and why is its possible eruption so serious?
Stratovolcanoes are one of the most common volcanic types. Stratovolcanoes are basically known for having more explosive eruption types. Those are the ones that produce big ash columns and can cause people to need to evacuate because the main hazards are fast-moving ones. These type of volcanoes, when they wake up and start resuming activity, are always a concern when they're near populated areas. And you mentioned ash. That is one of the main hazards we're seeing at El Popo right now. And it's actually really common at volcanoes all around the world because the volcanic ash is not like fireplace soot.
And what's the difference and what does it do to human health?
Volcanic ash is actually just pulverized rock fragments. So it's essentially lava that's getting burst apart. And when it fragments, the fragments can actually be extremely small, but they're very glassy. So they're sharp and angular. Basically, like if you took any rock around your house and crunched it up really fine, you'd get an idea of what volcanic ash is like. And so it can collapse roofs on buildings, it can choke airplane engines, it can cause roadways to become impossible to go through because it'll build up to several feet with big eruptions. It's not something you want to get in your eyes or swallow or breathe in as it can cause problems there too. So it's very important that people listen to local authorities so they don't get harmed by the volcanic ash, which is one of the unexpected ways volcanoes can hurt you.
So let's turn our sights to Italy now. On the island of Sicily, Mount Etna is acting up. It seems there actually is a small eruption. What are you seeing there?
It's a really fascinating volcano. It is absolutely massive, and it has a history of gigantic collapses when the rock that makes up the structure of the volcano actually just basically sloughs off due to gravity or due to the work of earthquakes and the work of erosion processes. And of course, people live all over Sicily. So in modern Etna territory, residents are often forced to deal with ash buildup on their cars. And there's a lot of gas emissions as well associated with it. So Etna is one of the most potentially dangerous volcanoes in the world, simply because of the size of the population that it can affect when it has a large eruption or a large collapse of one of the volcano's flanks.
And in eastern Congo, the Nyamuragira volcano has been glowing. A nearby volcano erupted in 2021, and that killed 32 people in Goma. Like Popo and Etna, millions of people could be affected by this one. What are you watching for in Congo?
So this area of the world is actually really well known for volcanic activity among volcanologists. But if you've heard the term Great Rift Valley, the continent of Africa is pulling in a couple of different directions. And so you have magma that's able to breach the surface there. And that is, it sets the stage for really interesting volcanic activity. This eruption at Nyamuragira is it's more like a Hawaiian style eruption because the volcano itself, it's not a stratovolcano. It's actually what we call a shield volcano. It gets the name from the image of a warrior shield laying on its side. So a gently sloping volcano, not your inverted V that everybody pictures. So Nyamuragira, it has a history of effusive eruptions. So not explosive. They're much more runny, I guess is the best way to put
right.
it. Lava flows will move like syrup, pancake syrup. So people can outwalk most lava flows. So at this volcano, even though it doesn't produce the violent large-scale eruptions that Etna or Popo can produce, it will harm people due to gas emissions, but also the ashfall yet again, because this volcano is fully capable of producing ash that will get into the workings of everyday life and gum things up.
So three important volcanoes on the planet all acting up at the same time. Is there something going on? Is any of this volcanic activity interconnected?
I actually love this question because this is one of the ones that I get to give you a really positive answer on.
Okay.
Which is actually three at once is no big thing because right now, as we're talking, there are between 45 to 50 volcanoes erupting around the world.
Wow.
And we just only hear about the ones that are near major population centers. So this is business as usual for planet Earth. And if we just think about it as an opportunity to get a glimpse into the beating heart of the planet, it contextualizes it a little better. And then if you're nearby, think about it as a chance to prepare for an emergency evacuation, even if you don't have to. And we hope you don't have to.
Well, you've perfectly set up my last question, Jess. I mean, you're a volcano expert and enthusiast. And often when volcanoes are in the news, it's about the destruction and people, which is totally understandable. Is it hard to love something, though, that you know brings a lot of fear and suffering?
It is. And I try to keep it in perspective for myself when I look at the scope of Earth's history, because in geologic time, humans are only here for the blink of an eye. I mean, we live in the order of tens of years, and volcanoes operate on the millions of year time scale, and the planet operates on the billions scale. So whenever I worry about people in the path of volcanoes, I have to think about the fact that it's up to us to live our lives around what the planet is doing, because we have the immense privilege of existing on a living planet that's currently reshaping itself and will do that long after we're gone. So I just look at it as an opportunity to just marvel at the spectacular gift we've been given of our planet.
Volcanologist Jess Phoenix is a writer and science educator. She joined us from Los Angeles. Jess, great to speak with you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Marco.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. This weekend, a huge moment for voters in Turkey for what's being dubbed the election of the century. About 60 million people are expected to go to the polls on Sunday for a presidential runoff between two candidates. The winner will certainly have his work cut out for him, dealing with a spiraling economy, rebuilding after devastating earthquakes, and navigating testy relationships between Russia and the West. The World's Duri Biskaran is in Istanbul following all of this. Hey, Duri.
Hi, Marco.
There is a lot at play here, and not just for Turkey. Set the scene for us.
Yeah, so 2 weeks ago, Turkey had its first round of voting. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan came out ahead with over 49% of the vote. He's been in power for 20 years and spent a lot of his campaign accusing his opponents of having links to terrorists. It was effective. He's running against Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, a former accountant and anti-corruption campaigner. Kılıçdaroğlu was polling really well going into the election, but he had a surprise showing of just 45% of the vote. After that, Kılıçdaroğlu has abandoned a lot of the human rights, pro-democracy rhetoric of his initial campaign, and he's gone full nationalist. He has a new anti-refugee campaign video. Here's some of it.
Vatanını seven bizimle omuz omuza versin. Vatanını seven sandığa yaz.
I mean, that just gives you an idea, but this video claims that if refugees stay in Turkey, millions more will come, the economy will suffer, crime will increase. If elected, Kılıçdaroğlu has promised to deport millions of Syrian refugees back to a war zone. And this is all from a guy whose signature move at rallies is to hold up a hand heart. You know, that thing where your thumbs are together and your fingers like curl over the top?
Right.
Quite a juxtaposition.
Yeah, it sure is. Well, that's kind of a stunning turnaround. Now, Duri, Erdogan is a strong man, and he's the incumbent at the top of the government. Are these elections considered fair?
Almost 90% of voters participated in the first election round 2 weeks ago. And this isn't a country without early voting or mail-in ballots. I mean, they're voting in person, waiting for hours, and it's incredible. People have not given up on democracy here. But we also know that the deck is stacked. Erdogan is in control of all branches of government, so thanks to a loyal judiciary, many of his political opponents are either facing legal charges or are currently in prison. And then there's also just old-fashioned voter disenfranchisement. A couple million voters who lost their homes in the earthquake this winter have moved to live in other parts of the country, and it was really hard for those voters to re-register to vote with their new addresses. Analysts believe that many of them would have backed Kılıçdaroğlu.
And Duri, as you reported for us, there were some inconsistent ballot results during the first round of elections, right?
Right. I mean, on election day itself for the first round, Kılıçdaroğlu's campaign was really quick to claim that there were irregularities at ballot boxes. And in some cases, some votes appear to have been transferred from Kılıçdaroğlu to Erdogan. Our Foreign Media Association also commissioned a statistical analysis that shows a higher number of invalidated votes in districts won by Erdogan, which suggests but doesn't prove that individual election committees might have invalidated votes for the opposition. But even if all of these potential votes went to Kılıçdaroğlu, it wouldn't be enough to change the outcome. At this point, the opposition is just demoralized and perhaps less likely to vote in the second round.
So Turkey is a big country with a big economy. It's a member of NATO and has been a big part of the balancing act between Russia, Ukraine, and the West. What are the potential global impacts of this election, Duri?
I mean, Turkey and the U.S. have a long-standing beef over Erdogan's purchase of a Russian missile defense system, the S-400. The U.S. says it's a security risk to NATO warplanes, and in retaliation, Congress has blocked Turkey from receiving F-16 fighter jets that Turkey actually helped develop. So if Kılıçdaroğlu wins, he says he'll bring Turkey closer to NATO. He said he would comply with Western sanctions against Russia, something Erdogan hasn't done, and Kılıçdaroğlu has even promised to revive Turkey's bid to join the European Union.
Well, we will certainly learn more after Turkish voters go to the polls on Sunday to choose their next president. Thanks very much for being with us, Duri.
Thank you, Marco.
Duri Bhaskaran is the world's correspondent in Istanbul. In a lot of Central America, less than half the population has access to the internet. But that might be changing. Last month, Elon Musk's satellite internet, Starlink, went live in El Salvador. The hope is that many more people will be able to get online, but there's concern that the connection to the net will not be accessible to everyone. Michael Fox has our story.
If you go onto YouTube and type in Starlink in El Salvador, you'll be overwhelmed with videos of users praising the arrival of the satellite internet to their country. Like this one. Two guys wearing shades unbox a Starlink antenna and router. They are clearly excited. Everyone is. Manuel Aguilar is the head of El Salvador's telecommunications agency. It doesn't matter where you are here in El Salvador, he said in a recent interview. At the beach, in the mountains, you can take your Starlink antenna, connect it to electricity, and you have high-speed internet. El Salvador is Latin America's tiniest country, and it is not usually on the cutting edge when it comes to information and technology. But it is today. The head of El Salvador's Chamber of Tourism, Carlos Umaña, says the arrival of Starlink is a potential game changer for that industry. I'm really proud that we can be pioneers in the region, he says. I think an alternative like Starlink is an excellent opportunity for our country to accelerate the development of tourism in the most remote areas of the country, he says. Umaña has been using Starlink for a month on an island in the country's remote Bay of Juquilisco. His latest tweet is a screenshot of his Starlink download speed there at 132 megabytes per second. Priceless, he writes in English. Priceless, but only for those who can afford it. Santos Germán Flores is with El Salvador's Community Radio Association.
En las comunidades alejadas, donde no hay cobertura.
In remote communities where there is no coverage, Starlink can solve the issue of internet connectivity, particularly for academics or businesses, he says. But for the vast majority of the population, the costs are really expensive and not at all accessible. He explains that it costs about $500 to buy the Starlink equipment, and then there's also a monthly service fee. For Salvadorians making minimum wage, that would eat up about 2 months of their salary. Tomas Perla is a journalist in La Unión, in the far eastern end of the country. He says this Starlink service is not aimed at low-income communities. It's not for the majority, but rather for a small group of the population that has the financial means to acquire it. But regardless of income, there is one group of Salvadorians that is already benefiting. Students. The government has begun to install Starlink in public schools around the country, including in remote areas. This recently posted government video shows officials setting up a Starlink antenna at a school on an island where internet access was just a dream until now. Smiling kids hold tablets in their hands and wave at the camera. This is clearly a promotional video, but the sentiment is real. With this new network, we can get our students online in class, says a school teacher at another rural school where the Starlink installation was covered by a local TV station. Up until now, the students had to sit in a nearby cemetery to get enough bars on their cell phones to hop online. El Salvador's president, Nayib Bukele, has promised to bring the internet to all 5,000 public schools in the country. Starlink is expected to expand throughout much of Central America later this year. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
More stories from around the globe still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. In Jerusalem, tattoo tradition goes back 700 years. Pilgrims across the globe go to one family there to get inked with Christian symbols.
Here we are. I am the 27th generation, and my two sons are continuing to do the tattoos and continuing this beautiful tradition.
Tattoos, body art, and symbols of faith still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In Ecuador, voters will soon go to the polls to elect a new president. It wasn't so long ago, just in 2021, when they last voted. This snap election is set for the 20th of August. It's happening because last week, President Guillermo Lasso took the drastic step of dissolving parliament. The World's TV Isaiah reports on what comes next for Ecuador.
President Guillermo Lasso is a conservative former banker. He became the president of Ecuador in 2021, and he's had a tough time governing since he took power. The National Assembly was led by the opposition and has been hostile to his proposals. In fact, the legislature has tried to remove him from office several times. In the latest attempt, lawmakers accused him of corruption and moved to impeach him. I'm here to tell you that it's not possible to resolve the problems of Ecuadorian families with an assembly that's only trying to destabilize the government, he said on May 17th. It was the same day he announced the dissolution of parliament. This was the very first time that a president in Ecuador used this constitutional tool.
The idea is the president can dissolve Congress once during his term, but he has to run for elections again. So general elections, both presidential and legislative.
Guilherme Long is a former foreign minister of Ecuador. He says this is known as muerte cruzada, which roughly translates into mutual death, because both the president and the parliament have to go. President Lasso described the move as, quote, an act of generosity for the country, and he said it was to spare people from the embarrassing spectacle of political infighting. But Guillaume Long has a different view.
So Lasso's dissolution of parliament was the result of his fear of being impeached. This gives Lasso some time, whereas impeachment would have given him any time. On the very day of impeachment, he would have stopped being president.
Lasso will now rule by decree for 6 months when a new president will be sworn in.
And so now this is an opportunity, of course, to do what he's been unable to do because of a hostile parliament.
But at least on paper, the president is actually quite constrained during these 6 months. He can only pass urgent decrees that will need to get the green light of a constitutional court. Lasso can also choose to run in the presidential election, but he told the Washington Post he doesn't plan to run. And there is a good reason for that, says Koya Chuguli. She's a local indigenous politician.
No ha sido una presidencia exitosa, ¿no?
She says Lasso's presidency has not been successful in addressing the country's problems, especially security. And now, Chuguli says, he's not very popular. In recent years, Ecuador has experienced a sharp rise in homicide, extortion, kidnapping, and other violent crime. Powerful criminal gangs are fighting for control of the drug trade. There have also been several deadly prison riots over the last 3 years. In the last local election in February, President Lasso's party did poorly across the country. But Koya Chuguli does not have high hopes for whoever ends up being the next president. It will be a year and a half of the same, she says, because there is not enough time for good leadership to emerge. Elections had to be organized quickly, within 3 months. Normally, this would take a full year. Political parties are in a rush to find candidates. Many of those running again are the same lawmakers that just lost their jobs. But Guilherme Long, the ex-foreign minister, says this might be a good opportunity for the country to reset.
The benefits are clear. You're going to have elections in 90 days. You know, you don't have big protests when you have elections in sight because people think, right, this is the outlet. This is the breath of fresh air we need. This is a way out of this political crisis.
Whoever wins this election in August will only have 18 months in office. That's because she or he will be serving out what's left of President Lasso's term. For The World, I'm Tibisa Isaiah.
Here is a tough-to-pronounce name that we unfortunately may be hearing more of, Acinetobacter baumannii. The World Health Organization says bacteria like it are among the greatest threats to human health. They can cause nasty infections of the blood, kidneys, and lungs. But in a major medical breakthrough, there is now an antibiotic to treat these problems. It took a big group of scientists from McMaster University and MIT to figure it out. And one more research partner of sorts, artificial intelligence. We called up the Stokes Lab at McMaster University in Ontario to help us understand. Jonathan Stokes is an assistant professor in biomedicine and biochemistry, and Gary Liu is a grad student and machine learning expert in Stokes Lab. Jonathan, you led this study. What makes this bacteria, this Acinetobacter baumannii, such a tricky bug for medical professionals to deal with?
Yeah, it's a mouthful, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is.
I don't know if I led the study so much as just sort of like held on while everybody else was working. It was remarkable to observe. But Acinetobacter baumannii it's a significant challenge and what we call in the laboratory a professional pathogen. It's a bacterium that lives in hospital settings. And you find it on, you know, hospital surfaces, doorknobs. You can find it everywhere, particularly in war fighters in the Middle East. You often see wounded soldiers who get Acinetobacter wound infections that are remarkably challenging. And it has a really unique ability in that it likes to take up DNA from the surrounding environment. You would imagine that oftentimes those pieces of DNA that it picks up contain antibiotic resistance genes. So we end up finding clinical isolates of Acinetobacter that are resistant to nearly every or every clinical antibiotic that we use.
A lot of people know about MRSA. Is it essentially the same thing?
It's more challenging than MRSA.
And historically, how do researchers find an antibiotic that can treat something like this? How long does the process typically take?
You know, anywhere from 10 to 15 years.
So Gary Liu, let me bring you into the conversation, because at some point in the development process, you needed help from AI, artificial intelligence. What was your job and what did you want the AI to be able to do?
You know, we have a lot of known antibiotics, obviously. And then my task for the AI was, okay, take all this previous information that we have on hand, and then let's see if you can learn what an antibiotic looks like. And then my next step for that is I'm going to show you a chemical that we don't know if it's antibiotic or not. And then this AI's job was to essentially let us know, is it going to kill Acinetobacter baumannii or not?
So tell me about when you first kind of used the AI. Where were you? What happened?
Before, you know, it even comes into existence, we have to gather so much data just so that it has a good body of work to learn from. That couldn't have been possible without, you know, a bunch of scientists grinding it out day in, day out in the lab. And then once we have an AI, let's call it smart enough to determine these antibacterial properties, what it looked like in the moment was it gave me a huge spreadsheet. And then my job was just to narrow down that spreadsheet to find, ultimately, Abacin.
Wow. So I'm just curious, like, how human-like did you see the involvement of AI in the process? Did you give the AI a name?
The AI, it doesn't necessarily have its own name. We're not going for, you know, Space Odyssey 2001 here. Sort of the generic name, I guess, for it, ChemProp.
ChemProp. So, Jonathan Stokes, once you had all this information, the smart enough data, how did you find out the antibiotic worked?
So we actually curated those 240 chemicals that the model thought were antibacterial, brought them into the laboratory and tested them. And out of those 240, the most potent was the molecule we followed up on, Abacin. Most antibiotics are what are known as broad spectrum. You know, they'll kill every bacterium that they come into contact with. So if you're a patient and you're taking a broad spectrum antibiotic, you know, if you're lucky, it'll cure the infection, but it's also going to induce something called dysbiosis. It's going to kill all the good bacteria that live in and on you that promote your health, right?
Yeah. I mean, how much was AI responsible for taking you to that narrow spectrum?
I would say that the AI actually did not take us to narrow spectrum. Mm. We, as the human scientist, observed, we discovered that it was narrow spectrum.
Gary, has the Stokes Lab had a party yet?
About this particular paper? No. In general? Yeah, sure. Why not?
Yeah, you know, you don't have to share the champagne with the AI. That's one advantage. Jonathan Stokes and Gary Liu are infectious disease researchers from McMaster University in Canada, speaking with us about the development of an antibiotic to tackle one nasty superbacteria. Thank you both.
Thanks, buddy.
Awesome. Thank you.
The idea used to be kind of radical, but these days it seems like everybody's got tattoos. Italians are apparently the most tattooed population in the world, with just under half the nation rocking at least one piece of ink. Sweden is second, by the way. The U.S. comes in third. Tattoos have been around a long, long time, though. The World's Matthew Bell looked into a centuries-old tattoo tradition in the old city of Jerusalem.
The Christian population here in Israel and Palestinian territories is really quite small, but the majority of the tourists, people who come here to visit from abroad, they are Christian tourists coming here to see the holy sites, visit the churches, and they want to go home sometimes with something that's a bit more permanent than like a souvenir.
How does it feel? Is it painful?
I'm fine.
Deborah Magina might not put it exactly in these terms, but she's taking part in a religious ritual that goes back hundreds of years. Magina's a Catholic pilgrim from São Paulo, Brazil, and she's getting a tattoo.
Eu tô aqui no estúdio mais antigo de tatuagem do mundo.
I'm here in the oldest tattoo studio in the world, she says. This trip has lifted my faith, so I'm marking this moment with a tattoo, and that's really important for me.
Muito obrigada.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome, of course.
pleasure.
I love my tattoo.
That's good.
Linda.
Magina's tattoo is simply the word gratitude in delicate script across the inside of her wrist. It's the sort of religious theme tattoo that the proprietors of this studio have been doing for generations.
My name is Wasim Razouk. I am a member of the Razouk family that has been doing tattoos for the past 700 years, 500 of which from in the Holy Land. And before that, we come from Egypt. So we are Coptic Christians who came from Egypt. We are a family that continues the tradition of tattooing pilgrims in the Holy Land. I am the 27th generation, and my two sons are continuing to do the tattoos and continuing this beautiful tradition.
Razouk grew up here in the Old City of Jerusalem, learning the art from his father and his aunt. In ancient times, he says pilgrims wanted to go back home with a tattoo to show that they'd made the perilous journey here. It was a status thing, he says. Nowadays, people like the idea of carrying on that tradition.
But also because they want to feel that they have become different now after they have become pilgrims, that they have renewed their faith, that they have walked the steps of Jesus, that they have lived the Bible that they have read on paper. Now they see it, they lived it. It's a completely different experience.
Razouk says he's done tattoos for people in their 70s, 80s, even 90s, who never had any interest in tattoos before coming here on pilgrimage. A lot of his customers are Westerners, but he also does tattoos for Christians who live in this region.
Christians, we are the minority here in Israel and in the Holy Land. We are, because we are the minority, they think we are weak.
It's not easy.
It's not easy. It's very difficult to be a Christian in the Holy Land. It's very difficult to be a Christian in the Middle East among people who sometimes never even heard about Christianity or what is this different religion that is not their own religion. And sometimes they know that you are a Christian, and that is reason to hate you even more, and not only to persecute you, but also to attack you.
And for that reason, some people get religious tattoos on parts of their bodies that their clothes will cover. Still, a lot of Christians from the region, Razouk says, choose to get something like a cross on their lower wrist to identify their faith, whatever the risk. Some of the most popular designs here in the studio go way back, like the image of St. George slaying a dragon. The Jerusalem cross, that's a plain Greek cross surrounded by four smaller ones, is also popular. Razouk has one of those on his left arm. It's next to another much larger tattoo.
This is one of my Harley tattoos here on my right arm. I also have a big one here.
Your left shoulder with the eagle.
Yes, with the eagle and the engine of the Harley. It's the heart of the Harley Davidson. And I love Harleys, I love bikes, and it's a part of my life.
Razouk tells me he managed to do a pilgrimage of his own a few years ago. He traveled to the Black Hills of South Dakota for the annual motorcycle rally at Sturgis. He says he didn't end up getting a tattoo on that trip, but he did bring home more than one T-shirt. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell, Jerusalem. It is the end of May. You know what that means. College students slap on a cap and gown to celebrate their accomplishments and try to ignore their crippling debt and existential angst about beginning the rest of their lives. The guiding light for them is the commencement speaker, the rich, the famous, the accomplished, who rattle off inspirational pearls of wisdom. This week, students at Johns Hopkins University had a surprise speaker show up on video link.
Graduates of the class 2023, congratulations.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, he told the class of 2023 about a recent trip he took to the front lines of the war in Ukraine and told the graduates, you remind me of the boys fighting for their country.
They and you have similar hopes for life, similar expectations from life.
With an important difference.
It comes down to the question of time. The time of your life is under your control.
So Zelensky said, do something with it. Zelensky wasn't the only head of state giving life advice. Finnish Prime Minister Sanna Marin urged NYU graduates to remember three things.
You have to want things to change. It is your turn to take over. And most importantly, don't be afraid.
President Joe Biden told the students at Howard University, one of the country's oldest historically black universities, that American history has not always been a fairy tale and that racism has long torn us apart.
But on the best days, enough of us have the guts and the hearts to stand up.
To stand up for the best that's in us and choose love over hate, he said. One more, another American president, Jed Bartlet of the West Wing, a.k.a. Martin Sheen. He quoted Robert F. Kennedy while speaking at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles.
Each time someone stands up for an ideal or acts to improve the lot of others or strikes out against injustice, they send forth a tiny ripple of hope.
These ripples form a current, he continued, which can sweep down the mightiest walls of injustice and oppression. Class of 2023, we are counting on you. Live music in the U.S. is feeling pretty normal again. Most COVID restrictions have been lifted. Stadiums are packed. But for many artists, the journey back to the stage has been long and difficult. This week on Movement, our series about music and migration, host Maclit Hedero talks with an artist who transformed her whole approach to performing.
Xenia Rubinos has always been an incredible live performer. I remember seeing her years ago. She was touring indie rock style at the time, and she brought a kind of raw energy and catharsis to the stage that we, the audience, we could just bathe in. I mean, total release. But that's not always how it felt to her.
I was kind of like really disembodied in performance. I was on autopilot. I think there were good things that were happening on the stage. There were good things that were happening in the music and in performance. But me, myself, was like, she had left the building. Like, she wasn't here anymore. I remember watching some videos of me playing and just being angry, just being really upset, watching myself, because I remember how I was feeling inside, how I was performing for everyone else, and how no one would know how I really felt, right? And it's always like angry.
Even before COVID started, Xenia was withdrawing from public life. After years of critical acclaim and constant shows, the whole experience of performance had become hollow, even toxic.
And so then all of a sudden the lockdown, it was like sigh of relief.
That total disruption of routine and expectations was the space that Xenia needed to process that her world had turned upside down, including the recent loss of her father. It created an opening for her to reinvent herself, her sound, and ultimately her live show. For Xenia, the reinvention began with the music of her childhood.
My dad would sometimes play rumba in the house. He would also bring me back music sometimes when he would go to Cuba. Bring me like burned CDs of like he would get on the street. And one of them was Los Muñequitos de Matanzas, which is a like seminal rumba group from Matanzas, Cuba. And, you know, it's just like when I would hear it, it would make me feel like I was listening to God.
Oh my God, I love that.
During that time, I was in a healing mode. Like when the pandemic happened, I was like baby steps every day, foot in front of the other. And so I, you know, the process of writing new music, I just was playing a lot of clave. Like it was just singing and playing clave. Try not to hear you, Nancy, but you're killing me. Every day, every day. And that was what I kept going back to, was just making all of these tracks of just voice and clave, and also these boleros. It was kind of like this wild goose chase of trying to reconnect with my father, who I had lost, just reconnecting with this music, you know, and paying homage to it ultimately in this record, writing my own bolero, writing my own like tragic diva bolero, and like the song Ay Hombre from Una Rosa is that.
A lot of the artists that we interview, we meet them online, but I've seen you live and I know about your killer show. But you've also really taken it up a notch. Could you talk a little bit about like the evolution of your live show?
Yeah, well, I hadn't played live in years, and I knew that when I returned to performance, I needed it to be different. So when I finished the album, or as I was finishing Una Rosa, and thinking about how to perform it live, it was clear to me that it needed to be about reconnecting in my body, and it needed to be about writing a ritual.
Mm.
You know, it kind of started little by little, but then I found Yara Travieso's work online, just on Instagram, like just luckily. And I was like blown away, and I saw a lot of myself in her.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, man, I wonder, it would be so cool to work with her on the staging. And I just like took a shot in the dark, was like, hey, I don't know you, but like, would you come and have a coffee with me? And at that point, my tour was booked. And I was like, hey, it's happening in a couple months, but like, I know this is crazy, but would you write the show with me? And that was my first time ever working with a director in this capacity, you know, to design a show that ultimately we're playing in like rock clubs, you know?
Did the healing ritual work?
Oof. Honey, let me tell you something. The most important show at the beginning of the tour was like hometown show, New York, my first time playing New York in years. We went out on stage and we're like, yes, and started the show. And from the jump, as soon as we got on stage, we were all like, wait, something is wrong.
What?
Something is terribly wrong with the sound. We're hearing like some strange thing going on with the playback. I'm like, something is weird, but we just keep going, right? Second song, all of a sudden, the entire PA goes out. Like everything just goes out. The sound goes out. But then it became clear they're not going to fix it. So now what are you going to do? Right.
Mm.
And something in me was like, yes, I know exactly what to do. I felt en mi salsa completamente. I felt like in my sauce. Mm. I was like, this is exactly what I do. And so I stayed in character and I started singing boleros. I started singing these old songs and just into the audience. I could hear, then all of a sudden I could hear them singing with me. And we ended up all singing together a cappella for 30 minutes, just singing into this room. But the transformative thing that happened on stage was this thought that came through, a flash. There was this voice that said, any moment that you are not doing this is a moment wasted. And that only happened in the New York show. It was only that one singular moment, you know? And it's like, I really think that it needed to happen. I think that that's what that show had to be, you know?
That was Senya Rubino speaking with Maclete Hedero for our series Movement, which is also a podcast all about music and migration. The series is produced by Maclete and Ian Koss. And that's going to do it for our show today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston, online at theworld.org. Enjoy the long weekend. We're back Monday with a special Memorial Day edition, stories of perseverance from the war in Ukraine. You be safe, stay strong, and thanks for listening.